You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is Whitney from Whale Scout, and today is our very first Whale Scout podcast. We are starting things off with a bang. Dr. Steven Swartz is on the show. He's the author of Lagoon Time, and it's a book about gray whales, especially the friendly gray whales that mate and give birth in Baja. So we're going to have him on, and we're going to talk a lot about gray whales. In the Pacific Northwest here, it's kind of like gray whale season. And so that's really exciting. But first, let's jump in here with the news and events that's they're coming up. We have the ACS meeting in Seattle, and Glenn Galley will be there talking about the western gray whales. Those are whales that live on the other side of the Pacific Ocean that are highly endangered. That'll be an awesome lecture. Welcome to Whales Day. That's happening on Whidbey Island. This is a Orca Network sponsored event. They do it every year. I've been a few times, and it's a pretty cool thing. It's family friendly. It's in Langland, Whidbey Island. They start off in the morning. You go to a local church, and they have educational booths, and then they also have costume making. So they encourage people to be in the parade that marches down the main street through Langley. And last time, I think I was the sun and my husband was the moon in the parade, and we held down the caboose, and it was a really important job, and it was a lot of fun. So they march all the way down through the main part of the town, all the way up to the waterfront park, where they give an offering to the whales. And there's music and singing, and it's a blast. And then in the afternoon, they have a lecture, and Mike Bursk will be there talking about the Baja friendly whales. And he actually worked with Dr. Steven Swartz. And so that's kind of cool. You listen to the lecture and you can hear more about the sort of work that they did together in Baja at this event. There is a orca and salmon recovery workshop in Seattle, and that's happening right before the Sailor Sea Ecosystem Conference is happening. It's only like $5 to go. It's presented by the Puget Sound Partnership, Orca Network, and the Sailor Sea Association of Marine Naturalists. So that will be awesome. I'll be at that one as well. Other news, things that are happening in the area, the Langley Whale Center is also open. So if you go up for the parade, you may as well stop in, check that out. I went a couple weekends ago with my husband, and it's in a really cool building in town. It's got educational panels on the walls. There's a little gift shop, friendly people working there. We got like free posters and stuff. It was awesome. So check that out. Langley Whale Center. It's part of Orca Network. So you can check out their website. There's a contest going on with Sound Action. I'm on the board of Sound Action as well. They're another local environmental group working on shoreline habitat protection. And they're giving away tickets to the Kiss the Sky Orca Freedom Concert. And it's this concert that's going on in Seattle at EMP in their Sky Church, where they have really cool concerts. It's going to be Heart with Graham Nash, Joan Jett, and the Blackhearts. And so they're going to be at the concert, and the project goes to support orca advocacy and research. So the tickets are like $75 each, or something like that. They're a lot. They were too much for me to go. But Sound Action has two tickets. If you go to their Facebook page, you can enter the contest and hopefully win the tickets. So go there, do that. All of these events are going to be up on the Whale Scout website, www.whalescout.org, in our event calendar section. And you can also check out our Facebook page, and we try to share all these events there as well. So let's talk a little bit more about the whales. This March, my sisters and I went with Orca Network on their trip to Baja, which they do almost every year. And I'll be writing a blog post about my trip, and I'm working on editing together some of our highlight clips from the whales, we had these GoPro cameras, and I had my camera, and we took a lot of footage, and I'm trying to edit them all together to have just one really cool video of all the whales. So these gray whales are, if you live on the Pacific coast, anywhere on the west coast of North America, this is the most likely whale that you're likely to see. And they have one of the most, the longest migrations in the world. They have spent their summers up in Alaska, in the Arctic, between Russia and Alaska, feeding. And that's all they're doing when they're up there, is they're feeding and feeding. And then they will migrate south all the way to Baja in Mexico. And there's three main lagoons that they'll go to. And San Ignacio, which is where we went, is in the middle. And it's where the gray whales will go to breed and to give birth. While they're there, they're not eating. And it's presumed by most scientists that, in fact, during most of their migration, that they're not eating much of anything at all. So they fast this entire time. And it's quite remarkable. And, you know, because the mothers are pregnant and then they give birth and then they are nursing their young while fasting. So it's incredible just because of their migration. And in these lagoons, way back in the day, they were hunted. And, you know, up until about 1946, when whaling stopped. And, you know, it stopped really because they had hunted any, you know, most of the whales out of there. It wasn't economically feasible for them to keep whaling there anymore. So, I mean, the populations were just decimated. And in the 40s, they were allowed to sort of, they're protected. And in fact, you know, in the U.S., all marine mammals are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And their numbers were given chances to recover. And then in the 90s, the gray whale was taken off of the U.S. endangered species list. They're like the only whale to be taken off of an endangered species list. So their recovery is remarkable. And like I said, if you live on the West Coast, you can see whales doing their annual migrations. You know, let's see, I volunteered in Oregon on the coast there. And it was the week after Christmas. You can watch them in pretty high numbers go south. I mean, they count them in whales per hour. So they're out there and they're counting how many will pass. And it's like 5-6 whales per hour. And that's just where people are looking. So it's a big migration. They really also they hug the coast, which makes it also easy for you to see them. So I'll talk a little bit about my trip down to Baja with Orca Network and my sisters. We all met in San Diego and we spent the night there. And then they load everyone up on a bus and they bus you over the border through Tijuana, which is interesting. Many years ago, I'd walked across the border, but they've totally redone their whole customs operation down there. And it's this nice, fancy, very clean building, and everyone gets off the bus and they check your stuff, and we went through really smooth. They take the bus and they put the whole bus through this x-ray machine that like scans the whole bus. And when I asked the driver what they're looking for, he just said guns and drugs. So I don't know how you x-ray for drugs, but that's what they did. And of course, we didn't have any of those, you know, contraband. So we were waved through. And on the way to Ensenada, we got a flat tire. And it's really interesting on the roads there. They have these trucks that just drive around. I think this is fairly common. You get a flat tire. And the trucks, they're just like pickup trucks, like a Toyota. And you can like flag them down or call them over. And they will just pull off on the side of the road with you and they will repair your tire. So you don't have to go to like a tire shop. You don't have to get towed anywhere. They come to you. So this happened to us, and a guy with like his 11-year-old kid jumped out of the truck, fixed our tire in like 12 minutes. We were back on the road, went to Ensenada, where we went to a very small airport. I couldn't really figure out if it was like a military airport. There are military people working there. But then it's like a charter flight. So you get on this little plane that holds about 14 people and you fly in to the lagoon area. And you fly over Guerrero Negro, which I'll talk a little bit about on the show later. And that's the first lagoon where a lot of the gray whales go. And then the second one, San Ignacio, is where we went. And you just land on a dirt strip. I mean, there's nothing. I have a video of the nothingness that was at this airport. And then they pick you up in this bus. They load all your gear in the bus. And about 20 minutes later, you know, sipping on cervezas and sodas, you arrive at camp. And there's, you know, no real like paved roads. All the camps that are out there, which support the whale watching tours, they're mostly just, you know, tents and stuff. We were kind of lucky that we had actual cabins because there's no wood down there. It's all desert. So they, you know, it was really expensive for them to bring in the wood. And they're all eco tours, like for real eco tours. It's all sustainable electricity. They're running off of solar and wind. You know, they're bringing in water because there's nothing out there. You're camping. And, so like I said, we had these cabins. We stayed in one little cabin with my sisters, and it's just, they have like a sleeping bag with a sheet on the inside to keep things clean. And, you just bring in your stuff, and they have another building where they serve you all of your meals, and they take you out whale watching twice a day. And then there's happy hour and meals in between and little presentations at night. And it was really cool. So I have pictures of, and then of course videos coming of the whales that we saw. We had great conditions the first day we went out. It was fairly calm. And there's only, I think we had like 6 people per boat, something like that. And then a guide and then the boat driver. And so you're in these small boats and the whales are out there. There's a lot of whales. It was a great year this year. They had a lot of whales returning to the lagoon because they do a census every year. And they sort of count. Some years are better than others. This was a great year. And yeah, we immediately had friendly whales. And of course, the boat drivers, they have a friendly whale in the area. They all know about it. They're all on the radio. And looking back now at the videos that I shot of my sisters and I, we were so like in shock when the whales just came right up to the boat, put their head like right into your hands and just were like puppy dogs. They just wanted to be scratched like puppy dogs. And towards the end of the trip, we were just like leaning out over the boat and, you know, nearly falling in trying to reach for whales. And on this first day, we probably had the friendliest group and we were so in shock. We didn't even know what to do. We're just kind of like touching it and then like putting our hand back in like, oh, that's nice. Oh, my God, that's so crazy. And you'll see on the video this the mother of this mother and calf pair liked to open her mouth. And so you can see all of the baleen inside of their mouth, which is just really cool. The baleen is used instead of teeth. They have baleen, which is just like it looks like kind of like string hanging down from their mouth, like in like long mats. And gray whales are really interesting, too, in that they are the only whale that's a bottom feeder. So that's also why they're very close to shore, is that they're spending their time in shallow water because they're diving all the way down to the bottom. And they kind of turn on their side. They scoop up mud and sediments and little shrimp and little amphipods that live in the sediment. And then they sift it out through their baleen. So all the junk goes out and all the good stuff stays in, and then they just swallow it. So that was really cool. I really wanted to touch the baleen, but like the whale would open its mouth and then like hump, just like clamp down after a couple seconds without any, you know, notice. And so, you know, even though they don't have teeth, I didn't really want to get my hand stuck in a 45-foot long whale's mouth. So anyway, that was an awesome trip, and photos are going to be up on the website. I'd love if you send me some questions on Facebook. I can talk a little bit more about them. And so now we're going to have Dr. Stephen Swartz on the show. He is a researcher at the Laguna San Ignacio Ecosystem Science Program, a 1986 graduate of the University of California at Santa Cruz, and has researched and published widely on gray whales and their breeding lagoons in Baja California. He served as a consultant to the Mexican government's Ministry for the Environment, Natural Resources, and Fisheries, and worked for the Ocean Conservancy, the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission, and the U.S. Marine Fisheries Service. He's the author of Lagoon Time, A Guide to the Gray Whales and the Natural History of San Ignacio Lagoon. So let's get him on the line here, and you're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast. All right, we are back on the show with Dr. Stephen Swartz, author of the book Lagoon Time, A Guide to Gray Whales and the Natural History of San Ignacio Lagoon. And I was saying, I was just in San Ignacio in March, and I was not able to get a hold of the book until after I got back. So I read the book after returning from the lagoon, and I just had a great time reading it. And thank you so much for being on the show.
That's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Great. So when you you mentioned in the book that you went down to Baja in the late 70s at a time when the gray whales were listed as an endangered species in the U.S., but backing up before then, how did you get interested in studying whales?
Well, that's a long story, but I'll make it short. I was a college student looking for a direction, and I always liked marine science because I grew up at the beach surfing and sailing. And so the only option I had was to take classes in oceanography and ichthyology and so on as an undergraduate in college. Joined organizations like the American Cetacean Society and was an associate at the Natural History Museum in San Diego, and became more and more interested in whales. But the thing that really did it was I took a job in between episodes of college and graduate school with SeaWorld of San Diego, and my job there was an educator. I worked in the education department, and I was surrounded by people that knew all about the care and feeding and natural history of dolphins and killer whales and beluga whales and walruses and so on. And I got really interested in marine mammals, and then got very, very interested in the gray whales that migrated right past my home in San Diego every fall and every winter. So started going to Baja to see them down in the lagoons, and that's when we discovered that there was some interest in what they were doing down in Mexico, because there was very little recent information about how many whales were there and how they were using the lagoons. So Mary Lou Jones, who ultimately became my wife, and I started going down to Baja on camping trips and looking at the whales, and that got us interested in them.
So you had spent a little bit of time there prior to going down there for research.
Yes, yeah. Baja was in our backyard. We were in San Diego, and so we could go on long weekends and go camping and surfing and hiking down in Baja, California. So it was a very interesting, fascinating place then, and it is today. And so that's what got us exposed to that part of Mexico.
That sounds great. You mentioned the struggles in just getting to the lagoon and setting up your camp on Punta Piedra. What was the best part about working and living there, and what was the most challenging part?
Well, I guess the most challenging part would have been the logistics, because there was 60 miles between the nearest paved road, and that's in the town of San Ignacio, to the lagoon. And in those days, it was just jeep trails through the desert and over rocks and up and down mesas and on across salt flats and so on. So it would take you all day, and that's if you didn't break down, just to get into San Ignacio, and then another day to get back out to the lagoon. So logistics were very, very difficult. We were able to solve a lot of that problem by making friends with and associations with the whale-watching boats that were coming down to the lagoons in those days out of San Diego. And if we would have some of our family members and friends load food and freight and supplies on those boats, they would bring it down to the lagoon, and we'd then meet them there and offload supplies. But it's still, even with that support, we still had to go into town from time to time for one reason or another. So that was the most challenging thing. The best part about being there was that in those days, there was very little human activity at all. There were maybe a half a dozen families that had lived along the shores of the lagoon or nearby, in family ranches. They'd lived there for generations. But there were no ecotourism camps or facilities or anything like that. So, you know, maybe 100 people in the immediate area, and we'd only see them from time to time when if they were fishermen, when they were going fishing, and we'd see them on the water. They'd go past Punta Piedra. So we were pretty much exploring the place for the first time and learning about it from the local people that live there and documenting everything that we experienced because it was all new in those days.
And so you mentioned a lot of the local fishermen. Are a lot of the families that were there when you were doing your research, are they still there today, and do they continue to be guides?
Well, yes, they are. We've lost some of the elders, of course, because time marches on, but their sons and daughters and grandchildren are now living at the lagoon, and they've made a transition in the mid-1990s when Mexico established the Biosphere Reserve that was going to put restrictions on their fishing activities, which was their main livelihood, during the winter months when the whales were there. So to make a long story short, they formed an association, a local community association of fishermen that wanted to embark upon developing ecotourism in the area so they could also make a livelihood during the months that the whales were there and they couldn't fish. And that was adopted by the Mexican authorities, and that's what's in place today. There's still an association of ecotourism organizations, companies, and they operate under a negotiated management plan within the Biosphere Reserve that's overseen by the Mexican government. They're what would be like our Fish and Wildlife Service or Interior Service that manages the Biosphere Reserve. And that's the way they're able to make a livelihood in the lagoon during those months when the whales are there and they can't fish. But yeah, the family names are still around, and like I said, the grandchildren and the children of those folks that we first met down there are still alive and well and doing great.
Yeah, when I was there, the people were just amazing. The guide, the boat drivers, just all really, really nice, very knowledgeable. Yeah, they made the lagoon really special, I felt.
They go out of their way to invite the visitors and the guests to experience as much as they possibly can. They realize that the attraction, of course, in the winter are the whales, but then once people get there, like yourself, and I hope you would agree with this, there's so much more than just the whales. There's the birds, there's the habitat itself, there's the desert, there's the wind, there's everything that you're exposed to that you just normally don't get to experience in most of our day-to-day lives. And they're proud of showing that off. They're very happy that people have come, paid money and come great distances in some cases to see the place, to see the whales and to experience it. So they're very eager to show it off and to make sure they can do whatever they can to make it a positive experience for people that come to visit.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the book that each year you'd come back having learned a little bit more Spanish. Did that really help you, you know, to get more expertise out of these locals?
Well, of course, yeah. A couple of interesting things have happened there. We would leave the lagoon after being there for 3 months in the winter, reasonably able to carry on a conversation. Of course, then we'd come back to the United States at home, and we wouldn't use our Spanish, so we would forget it. And then we'd go back in the winter and have to relearn a lot of things. When we started mentoring students down there in the late 90s and now into the 2000s, most of the students didn't speak any English. And so, again, it was a chance to immerse ourselves in Spanish and get better at that. But as time has gone along, I would say probably 75% of the students that are part of our programs down there now all speak English as well as Spanish. Mm. And so they want to practice their English. And so we've lost our Spanish lessons to a certain extent. So we're pretty multilingual or bilingual down there. But that brings up another point. The visitors that come to the lagoon, if you go to one of the campgrounds or one of the ecotourism camps, it's not unusual to hear a half a dozen different languages being spoken, right? German, French, you know, Japanese, Indonesian dialects and so on. Because, again, people are coming from all over the world to see this place.
Yeah. And is the site of your camp, is it still being used? Is that where one of the ecotours has their camp now?
Yes. Punta Piedra is a rocky point, is a constriction in the lagoon about a third of the way in from the entrance. It's the narrowest part of the lagoon, so all of the water that moves in from the ocean and floods back into the uppermost part of the lagoon is about 30 kilometers in total length. flows back and forth through that constriction, and so it's a very good place to observe whatever's going on in the lagoon, whales or otherwise. And that land, you know, with the establishment of the Biosphere Reserve and changes in the Mexican laws for titleship of the land, is now owned by one of the local people, and they lease that land to an ecotourism company that has a camp there every winter.
And so is research still being conducted at that site?
At that site, no. We've yielded it to guests and visitors that come to the lagoon because it's such a wonderful place to see the whales and everything else. Our research camp is, which started in 2006 for the ecosystem science program that we now have in place there, is about three-fourths of the way up the lagoon on the southern shore at a campground called Cuyamita. It's operated by the Cuyima Ecotourism Company, and they allow us to pitch our tents there every winter and open up a small field station that's about a 20 by 20 building with a thatched roof, but we have solar and wind power that keeps the electricity on at night, so we have lights and we can charge our camera and other batteries, computers, and so on. So that field station is not out on Rocky Point. It's up in the middle of the lagoon.
Great. And so a lot of people, you know, most of the visitors, they're going to the lagoons in search of gray whales, and especially the friendly gray whales, the whales that for whatever reason seem to want to come up to a boat and be touched. What is your reason for why these whales are friendly? And I've also heard that this friendliness is sort of spreading among whales, and it seems that each year there are more and more friendly whales. So why do you think this is?
Well, I think the reason, let me start with the first part, or the last part of your question, that I think the reason is that whales are curious in general about their environment, and the generations of many species of whales that we have now have never been hunted or harassed by people. They do have problems with ship strikes and fishing gear and all those sorts of things, pollution in some areas, but no one's really gone out and pursued them, so there's no innate fear of humans in general, generally speaking. And after watching the gray whales and living with them for over a 30-year period, starting in the 70s and up to the present, I really can't give you, you know, a specific reason why they are friendly, but I've got some ideas that what it may have contributed to that. The first is, of course, that the generation of whales, like I just said, that we're seeing and we're encountering have never been harassed or frightened. In the lagoon habitat, the environment around them is pretty tranquil. I mean, it has its physical characteristics with the tides and so on, but as far as the humans, the whale-watching guides, the naturalists, don't really pursue the whales. They don't go after whales. They put themselves in the presence of whales. And as you found firsthand, they just sort of motor around waiting for whales to come by and then just kind of slide in next to them and just watch them for a while. And some of those animals, again, are curious enough that this boat is not harming them. It's not biting them like a killer whale or a shark. It's just kind of following them around. So it's sort of a benign component of the ecosystem, these little boats floating around with their motors humming away at low frequency, which the whales can hear. And, of course, the passengers taking pictures and squealing in delight and joy when a whale comes close by. So they're not afraid of that particular part of their environment. Now, I'll point out that, although I can't put a firm number on it, most of them whales, probably 80 or 90% of them, could care less about the boats. They're there for other reasons. They're breeding. Their hormones are raging. They're either adult males and females that are courting and mating for the next year's calf production, or they're females that bred the previous year and they now have a young calf that they're taking care of. So they're milling about doing their whale business. But there are a few that, again, are not only not intimidated by these little boats floating around in the zone where whale watching is allowed, but they're curious enough to come up and explore them. And, of course, whales are very tactile. They rub against each other. They rub against their environment. And so if they come close to a boat and bump up against it, they can hear it. They rub it. It doesn't bite back. And then if people reach out and touch them, it's like rubbing a dog or a horse or any other animal. You know, it reinforces the behavior. And that's how friendly whales develop, in my opinion. That's how it happens.
Yeah, when I was down there, it was in March, and so it was, I think, I don't even think we saw any male whales. It was mostly mothers with calves. And it was really clear the whales that were friendly and the whales that were not friendly. And it was, there were certain whales, and we, from day to day, we would actually recognize certain calf, mother and calf pairs. And there was one pair that, you know, on day two, they weren't friendly. We saw them again on day three. They were not friendly. And yeah, it just seems like it's almost like a personality trait. Do you think that this friendliness could ever get the gray whales in trouble once they leave the lagoons and they might run into a boat that is not friendly back to them?
Well, that's a philosophical question, I suppose. theoretically, it is illegal in the United States waters to pursue, hunt, or harass, or kill, or injure a whale. So someone would actively, consciously violate that federal law that we have, that we operate under as U.S. citizens. That's not to say that a boat can accidentally collide with a whale. We see scars on the ones that survive these types of collisions that are pretty obvious that they've had an encounter with a boat. Others get trapped in fishing gear, which runs, you know, if they're curious about floats or nets in the water, they run the risk of getting entangled, and a few do each year. So I think as long as they're in waters where the humans have an awareness that are protected species and they're there to look at them and not injure them, they shouldn't have any problems. Then again, if they slide over into other territorial waters where people pursue whales and hunt them, for example, the Arctic native communities have licenses both under U.S. law and Russian law to hunt a certain number of animals for subsistence purposes. Yes, you know, if they were going to nuzzle up to one of those boats full of Native Americans that are out hunting, that could be a problem for them. But in general, I don't think that it's going to result in any issue, you know, problems for the whales.
Yeah. And I was talking with one of my friends from the Seattle area, and she had been a guide for many years at the lagoon. And everyone sort of has their own theories of why they're friendly, which ones are friendly. And, you know, my sisters and I, when we would go out, you know, on day two, we're already trying to come up with different trends that we're seeing, you know, and,
sure.
You know, dolphins were our good luck charm. When you see a dolphin, there's going to be a friendly gray whale. But my friend who was a guide, she had the theory that whales that still had the hair follicles that were apparently very young were more likely to be friendly. And maybe this has something to do with the fact that they've grown up in an environment that the boats around them are friendly. Do you think there's any, you know, substance to this?
I can't think of any correlation between the presence of hair follicles on the head of a gray whale and their, you know, tendencies to be curious about boats with people in them. All gray whales are born with those little vestigial bristles on their heads and snout and chin, and they continue to have those throughout life. They don't go away. They're born with them, and they're there. That's the remnants of their mammalian heritage as far as fur goes. What happens as they get older is they get incrustations of barnacles and whale lice and scars that obliterate some of those hair follicles, but I don't really, in my mind, I can't see any relationship between that and a tendency to be curious about boats.
Interesting. And your book shows a lot of photos, and some of them are identification shots that you and other researchers had taken in order to track and identify individual whales over the years. What were some of your more memorable whales? And can you tell us some stories maybe about Gracie and Bopper?
Well, first of all, yes, as you observed and mentioned earlier, you can tell the whales apart because of their markings. There are no two that are identical. They're like fingerprints. They have a natural pigmentation pattern that they're born with that evolves as they reach adulthood, but then they also get overlain scars and other things that create these very distinctive patterns on their skin, and that's how we tell them apart. So we can recognize whales throughout a season, throughout a winter, but also ones that return each year, and also whales that move between the three breeding areas, Scammon's Lagoon, San Ignacio, and Bahia Magdalena to the south. So it allows us to track individuals and learn about them. With females in particular, it allows us to identify a female when she is a single whale breeding and then following the birth of her calf when she has a calf. And if we see this animal, say, over a 7 or 8 year period, we can see how frequently she successfully raises a calf. And if we sum all that across all the whales that we see, that gives us an index of how healthy the population is in a reproductive sense. So it's a very valuable tool, just digital photography. It gives you a wealth of information about whale behavior and their biology. As far as individuals, yeah, you get to recognize some individuals. You mentioned bopper. There have been several of those whales over the years, and they get nicknames like that because they're overly aggressive with objects like boats in the water. And rather than coming up in a peaceful sort of sense and just letting themselves rub against the boat or let people touch them, they come up and they give the boat a good smack or a whack, and that can be a little disconcerting. And right away, if an animal is like that, it's clear that you want to, you know, stay away from an animal like that just for safety reasons, particularly with whale watchers in a boat. So the word spreads that a particular whale looks a certain way, and if people experience it, they end up tending to avoid them. The flip side of that are those whales that are habitually curious and keep coming back for more, make the rounds of as many boats as they can get to in a day. Just everybody seems to come home in the evening with a picture of the same mother and calf or the same whale because they're habitually, you know, friendly. They're just going around all the boats. They just can't seem to get enough interest in seeing the boats. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of the two extremes, the overly friendly that just won't leave you alone versus those that you want to leave you alone.
When we flew in to the lagoon, we flew over Guerrero Negro, and we saw all of the salt ponds there. And then later in our trip, we learned that these salt ponds are very toxic. And what are they using this salt for? Like, where is all that salt going?
Well, the desert and the winds that blow there and the flooding of the desert by the tides creates a natural brine pans. And it's just a natural process. On the highest tides of the year during the new moons and full moons, the ocean floods the lagoon. It spills over its banks into these shallow areas of the desert and creates big pools of salt water. And then when it recedes, the water's trapped there. And this happens over hundreds and thousands of years. You get huge deposits of naturally occurring salt in the desert. And these have been known from earliest historical times as sources of salt, because salt is a human commodity, a commodity valued by human societies, and has been a trade issue throughout history of Baja and other parts of the world where this occurs. Well, in the 1960s, a company started artificially manipulating the desert and creating these brine pools, artificial ones, and pumping water into them to kind of force the evaporative action to create salt, to see if they could build enough salt to make a commercial commodity of it in it. And that's exactly what's happened in Guerrero Negro. I don't have the figures off the top of my head of how much salt is produced there, but it is, I think, the second or third largest world producer of raw salt for industrial as well as for food production in the entire world. I know here in Maryland, we actually get Guerrero Negro salt scattered on our roads during the snowy season.
Wow.
To help melting the ice. But a lot of it's sold overseas for chemical purposes, the manufacture of plastics and pharmaceuticals and so on. It's industrial grade when it leaves there, but it then can be refined even down into table salt for human consumption. So that's what the salt is used for. And then basically what they've done in Guerrero Negro, which is the north of Scammon's Lagoon, is enhance the natural process by, you know, excavating those large salt pans that you saw from your flight over, so that they sequentially evaporate the salt, the seawater. It goes in first as seawater. As it reaches a certain specific density, it's then pumped into an adjoining pond that's a little bit saltier, and then they keep doing that in sequence. And so the brine gets saltier and saltier and saltier as the water evaporates out of it. And ultimately, in the last of the ponds, it dries to a crusty white salt. And these deposits are several meters thick, and they actually go out and harvest the salt with these big industrial machines and then put it on barges and ship it overseas and goes around the world. The salt itself is not toxic, but when you concentrate seawater, you get, you know, calcium carbonate, you know, and other heavy metals that are also in seawater, but they become concentrated just like the salt. And so you end up with salt and then this kind of liquid brew of very, very heavy metal substances. And that's a waste product, and that's always been a disposal issue for the salt companies.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in your book that you had worked a lot in San Ignacio because a similar sort of salt operation wanted to move in there. And is this still a threat today at all?
Well, it was at the time. During the 1980s, there was a proposal between a multinational company that was the Mitsubishi and the Mexican government to develop a second evaporative salt works in San Ignacio Lagoon because they felt the futures of the salt market internationally would make this a profit-making enterprise. In order to do that, they would have to replumb San Ignacio Lagoon like they've done the northern part of Guerrero Negro, and it would have changed the place forever. Now, this happened right at the same time that the Biosphere Reserve was being put in place and, you know, getting set up, and the ecotourism was developing. And so there was a huge outcry internally within Mexico and internationally that changing San Ignacio Lagoon, you know, from its wetland characteristic to an industrial salt facility just would be a major loss, particularly when Mexico is trying so hard to maintain all of its wilderness areas and making them national parks or biosphere reserves or whatever. So the long and the short of it was the president of Mexico at the time, after a five-year debate, said that no, building a salt facility in San Ignacio would be inconsistent with Mexico's conservation program for that area, for that region. And so the project was canceled, and it never took place. In the meantime, I mentioned that the ownership laws within Mexico of land had changed, and now many of the residents of the lagoon and other people that had come out and started developing ecotourism now had title to the land, so they owned it. They could lease it, they could sell it, they could rent it, do whatever you want with it. Well, the association decided they wanted to put conservation easements on the parcels they controlled so that they would not be developed, because what they were offering the ecotourists was a wilderness experience, and so to develop it would counteract that, and they wouldn't be able to offer that experience to their clientele. Similarly, other lands that were privately owned around the area were approached by conservation organizations and coalitions and the Association of Ecotourism, and they were convinced to also put legal measures in place that would protect those lands from future development. Even if they changed title, the land is now protected pretty much the entire perimeter of the lagoon. The last parcel of land were federal lands on the northern shore, and I believe in 2012, Mexico finally agreed to declare those as part of a wildlife reserve and put the equivalent of conservation easements on them so they would never be developed. So it's not impossible that someone would try to come in and propose another industrial development there, but the legalities are now stacked against it. And there's a precedent set within the Biosphere Reserve that the San Ignacio Basin, if you want to call it that, the watershed, is part of a very unique habitat, and it would be very difficult, in my view, for someone to make that happen.
Yeah, it seems like the Mexican government has just done a remarkable job creating the biosphere and carefully planning their ecotours with sustainable development. I was personally blown away when I was there at how well regulated the lagoon was. And so I really appreciate you coming on the show and writing the book. I recommend this book for anyone going to San Ignacio or anyone who's just interested in whales at all. The book is great. It gives an awesome history of the lagoon, even back to Charles Scammon, a whaler who visited the area and took many whales. It talks about the scientific research that you conducted, and it also includes a really cool section of like a field guide almost to the birds, the plants, the other animals that are seen in San Ignacio. So it's a really unique book. And I want to thank you for coming on the show and give you an opportunity to let everyone know where they can purchase the book and to just share or plug anything else that you'd like.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words. The objective with the book was to provide an income stream to support the Laguna San Ignacio Ecosystem Science Program, which is the research that independently monitors the whales and all the other wildlife that are at the lagoon so that the community and the managers have some feedback as to what's going on in the lagoon. So every book that's sold, the profits go directly back to the research program, which is a project of the Ocean Foundation, which is a Washington, D.C.-based environmental group dedicated to conserving the ocean. So I encourage you to have your friends take a look at the book. If they're interested in it, they can purchase it. Feel good about where their funds go because the money goes back in to support the ongoing research at the program at the lagoon. And it can be found, it's distributed by Sunbelt Books in El Cajon, California. You can Google them on the internet, that's Sunbelt Books, and you can get a copy from them. They're also distributing it to all the usual suspects, you know, the bookstores, Amazon.com, and so on, so you can find it there. But I think the best way to get it would be to go visit Laguna San Ignacio, because the ecotourism companies down there have also obtained copies of the book and are making them available to their visitors and their guests. So that's the best way to get a hold of one.
Awesome. And we'll include a link on our website. And I just want to thank you again. This is Dr. Stephen Swartz, author of the book Lagoon Time. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for coming to visit us, and hope to see you again.
Thank you. We're back here on the show, and I wanted to just run down what's going on in Puget Sound, Pacific Northwest waters, where you can see whales. What's been going on in the last few weeks? We've been having some transient killer whales kind of in and out of the area, and these killer whales are feeding on seals, other mammals that live in the water. They're not the resident orcas that people go crazy about in this area. Those guys will be seeing, you know, any time now up in the San Juans. They should be returning. But in Puget Sound, we've been seeing a lot of these transient killer whales. And it's kind of interesting, too, because we, in the spring, have gray whales. So we're doing the Welcome the Whales parade in Langley. And it's really celebrating the fact that we have gray whales that you can see here, you know, off of Everett. They call them Saratoga grays because they're in Saratoga Passage, which is between Whidbey Island and Kameno. They're using that area to feed on ghost shrimp. And it's a pretty cool thing that we have here. In we even have a couple whale watching boats that go out and that look for gray whales. That's how consistently these guys are being seen from the Whidbey Island area. Keep your eyes peeled if you're up there, and you'll see them. They're feeding, so really close to land, and they're awesome to go look at. One last reminder, April 15th is your last day to comment on the Navy's Pacific Northwest Training Complex. This is an area offshore from Washington, Oregon, and Northern California where the Navy practices a lot of their war exercises. So any use of sonar or explosives, they're going to be practicing that, you know, out there. I went to the public meeting that was in Everett a month or so ago, and I was shocked at how few people were there. So it's really important that you send in your comments on this environmental impact statement. And, of course, the Navy has, you know, is arguing that they need realistic training opportunities to prepare for combat situations. And as many of you know already, a lot of marine mammal scientists are arguing that the use of sonar and explosives is, you know, extremely harmful for marine mammals and whales, who are very sensitive to sounds underwater. That's how they communicate. They have their own echolocation to, you know where they're at and communicate with other whales and find food. So April 15th, you can go to www.nwtteis.com or just Google, you know, Northwest Training Complex for the Navy comments. I want to thank you all for listening today to the Whale Scout podcast. Please, if you want to include any of your upcoming events, please email them to me at director@whalescout.org. And I'd like to thank you guys a lot for listening, and we'll talk to you again. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Thank you.